Cuba is rapidly running low on oil and is facing a humanitarian crisis as a result of the United States reimposing its Cold War era embargo on the island. This comes as the U.S. claims the Cuban government poses an unusual and extraordinary threat and is cooperating with dangerous adversaries. So why is the U.S. ramping up pressure on Cuba again? I started asking lecturer and PhD candidate at the University of the Sunshine Coast, Juan Zahia Naranjo Caceres, about the latest on Cuba's political and economic situation.
Yes, so what people in Cuba describe today is an everyday life marked by fuel shortages, long blackouts, and spiraling prices. UN agencies and independent reporters talk about the risk of humanitarian collapse, which gives you a sense of how serious this is. So fuel is at the center of everything. After Washington moved to block Venezuelan oil and threaten countries and companies that supply fuel to Cuba, and blackout of 12 to even 20 hours a day have become common in some regions. So that means bridges don't work, children can't study at night, water pumps fail, and entire neighborhoods go long and stretches with irregular water service. Public transport is also breaking down. Petrol stations are often dry or have huge queues. Buses are canceled. So health services are under real strain as well. Hospitals trying to run operating rooms and intensive care units with unstable power and fuel, and struggling to maintain cold chains for vaccine and medicine. The UN in Havana has explicitly warned that the coming fuel shortages, food insecurity, and a fragile health system could push large parts of the population into huge humanitarian need. And at the same time, hundreds of thousands of Cubans have left in recent years, especially young and skilled people, which this, of course, deepens labor shortages and the sense of a country being drained of its future. So yes, the situation is very, very serious, very terrible for many families. And this is very important. It's not a random crisis. It has been sharply worsened by deliberate external pressure on fuel and finance. It has interacted with internal economic weakness.
With this long-standing situation, I'm going to go more into the sanctions. So, Juan, why do you think the U.S. still has not dropped sanctions, especially considering relations between the nations had improved back in 2016? Maybe it wasn't the biggest improvement, but it was still at least a step in the right direction. And why didn't that usher in an end to the sanctions, even though Cuba has been gradually opening up its economy in some form?
There are two key reasons. I think the way the embargo is written into U.S. domestic law and the way Cuba is used in U.S. domestic politics. So those two factors explain why even the 2016 opinion never really translated into lifting sanctions. So legally, central instrument in the U.S. domestic law is the Helms-Burton Act of 1996. That is an act of Congress whose full name is the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act. So that act codified the embargo, meaning it took what had been a set of presidential sanctions and rolled them into actual law. From that point, a U.S. president could loosen or tighten regulations, but could not simply end the embargo without Congress changing the law. So the Helms-Burton also seeks to deter foreign investment by threatening lawsuits and visa bans against companies and individuals from third countries that traffic in ex-property, which is why it has been strongly criticized by the European Union and Canada, for example, as contrary to international law. So on top of that, you have additional layers here, such as placing Cuba on the U.S. list of, quote here, state sponsors of terrorism, end quote. So the U.S. government has also blacklisted Cuba entities linked to armed forces or security apparatus, which this add more political and bureaucratic obstacles to a way of normalization. Even when the Biden administration began to roll back the terrorism designation, it did not and could not dismantle the core embargo. He did that 1 week before the end of his administration. So politically, Cuba remains deeply tied to Florida electoral dynamics and to symbolic debates about socialism in U.S. domestic politics. So Obama's rapprochement normalized diplomatic relations, funded travel and remittances, and allowed some commercial ties, but it deliberately stopped short of touching the Helms-Burton Act. As you remember, Obama visited Cuba. So the Trump administration reversed many of those openings. And then in early 2026 this year, escalated to an explicit full blockade, as we know. So he threatened tariffs on third countries and targeting shipments, which UN experts and many states have condemned this as unlawful. So meanwhile, Cuba has gradually opened parts of its economy. They have legalized small and private businesses. They have been seeking more foreign investment and relying heavily on remittances. But in Washington, those reforms are often dismissed as cosmetic, and the Cuban state handling of protests and dissent is used to justify keeping or tightening those sanctions. The sanctions persist not because they are improving life in Cuba or advancing democracy, but because they are embedded in U.S. law and domestic competition and increasingly serve as economic regime change.
You touched upon very briefly in your answer, you mentioned countries like Canada. So we've seen the rule-based world order based on the UN Charter take a big hit, or some might argue it's already seen its demise. So with that being said, do you think we'll see middle powers such as Canada, Australia, smaller EU states start adding more pressure on ending sanctions? Or do you think this is just some lip service that won't go anywhere?
So I think you're absolutely right. Cuba is a very sharp test of whether the so-called rules-based order is real or mostly rhetorical. So on paper, the vast majority of the states, including Australia, Canada, and the European Union countries, reject the embargo in theory. But in practice, most stop at criticism and symbolic votes. For example, in the 2025 United Nations General Assembly voted ending the embargo every single year since the embargo was imposed. So 165 countries supported the resolution. Only 7, led by the United States, voted against and 12 abstained. These numbers changed every year. Normally, the people that are against lifting the embargo, of course, the United States and Israel. Sometimes other countries join sometimes, but the overwhelming majority of countries consistently have voted against the embargo. So European Union members, Canada and Australia all voted in favor in 2025 and described the embargo as contrary to the UN Charter and as a form of collective punishment. So Australians' explanation of vote explicitly called for sanctions to respect international law and not to impede access to basic needs. Yet beyond New York, their actions are cautious. The European Union has a blocking statute meant to shield European firms from Helms-Burton Act, but in practice, banks and companies remain very, very reluctant to engage with Cuba because they fear U.S. penalties and losing access to the dollar system. Canada, for example, maintains long-standing investment and tourism links and has criticized U.S. extraterritorial measures, but it has not led a coalition of countries to guarantee fuel or build insulated financial channels to Cuban trade. Australia consistently votes against the embargo and hosts critical debates, such as the article it just published in the Australian Institute of International Affairs. So then this is about economic warfare and the erosion of the rules-based order, but it has not moved into more assertive policies that would materially offset U.S. pressure. But at the moment, it is closer to mostly rhetorical support than any real confrontation with Washington sanctions. That said, there is a room for middle powers to do more if they choose to do that. They could expand humanitarian carve-outs to support fuel and food shipments under UN supervision, or push for clear global rules that prohibit sanctions which undermine access to food, water, and health services. Whether they take those steps will tell us about whether that so-called rules-based order has substantive content or is mainly a vocabulary that coexists with unilateral economic coercion.
So we've talked about the oil a lot in the whole situation. So I'd like to know, is it true Cuba is now relying on renewable energy like solar and wind as a workaround to the oil shortages with Chinese help?
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. So there is a real hopeful story here, but it needs to be framed carefully. Cuba has made remarkable advances in solar energy with strong Chinese support, which gives some hope and agency, but it is not yet a full workaround to the current oil shock. So over the past 12 months, Cuba has connected 49 new solar parks to the grid, adding more than 1,000 megawatts of capacity with equipment, financing, and technical assistance and support from China. But according to reporting based on Cuban Chinese sources, Beijing has committed to help build 92 solar parks by 2028, with a combined capacity of about 2,000 megawatts, almost matching Cuba's existing fossil fuel power capacity. So this is huge. China has also donated around 70 tons of generator parts and pledged 10,000 small voltaic systems for isolated homes and also critical facilities like maternity wards and clinics. Both governments explicitly present this as a project of energy sovereignty. Chinese officials talk about this firm support under all circumstances, and Cuba's energy minister has called the cooperation strategic for resisting the U.S. energy siege. This shows that Cuba is not simply a passive victim here. With partners like China, it has managed under enormous pressure to triple the solar share of its electricity mix in a year and to build a platform for a cleaner and more independent major energy system. So there is hope. However, we need to be honest here. The grid is still old and fragile, and even with much more solar, Cuba needs stable, firm generation that can run at night and in bad weather. Today, that still means oil and gas. But there are also bottlenecks in transmission, and so not all new renewable capacity can be fully used. And above all, the present crisis is driven by an abrupt externally induced collapse in oil supplies. Imports cut dramatically after the U.S. moves to block Venezuelan shipments and threaten other providers, as we mentioned before, which no renewable build can fully compensate for in the short term. So yes, Chinese-backed renewables are one of the most hopeful developments, widening Cuba's strategic options, and also they reduce future dependency on imported fuel. But there are sort of a medium-term solution. They soften the blow today, but they don't make the fuel blockade irrelevant, unfortunately.
That was Juan Zahir Naranjo Caceres from the University of the Sunshine Coast, ending the report.